Welcome to another episode of Threads of Enlightenment. As usual, guys, you know my custom right here is to welcome our guests because I know they're coming with a couple of things very expensive in my eye. Number one, time. 24 hours has been given to every single one of us. How you love her, how you embrace her, how you appreciate her will tell me much about you. Your love for time is going to expose who you are. The other is the journey. Journey is so powerful. It has creative power. It has created the individual that is before us, that is allowing us into her life so that we can get glimpse of wisdom, insight, understanding, so that you and I can become better human spirits while we're here. And I want to thank Brigitte for coming here at Threads of Enlightenment and sharing both of those quality commodities here with us. Welcome to Threads.
Hi, Ken. Thank you so much for having me. I love your energy and just your zest for life.
Thank you so much. Tell the folks, how do you serve? As I mentioned to you before, this is one of the questions that I ask so that those that are hearing and listening to us will understand that while we are here on this planet, it's not just all about you. It's also about all the other beings that are here on this earth, occupying it while we are here. So how do you serve mankind?
Well, how do I serve mankind? Woof. That's a big question.
I know, isn't it?
in truth, you know, I'm really here to empower and to inspire people to live a far more fulfilled life because we don't always understand how to get there because we're so bogged down within this societal created artificial paradigm, as I call it. You may call it the matrix, but I call it an artificial paradigm. And we're just here, and I needed to learn this. And of course, I work with the many, many masters, but the Ascended Master Saint Germain always says, Brigitte, we're here to return to a love for ourselves and each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we're born, and as you said, when we're born, we're born pure, but we're born with a lot of trauma. And it's by overcoming our trauma and understanding life and what it's all about that we become more in tune with ourselves, because everything on this plane is an illusion. I call it the laughing hall of mirrors. Yes. But serving the planet, it's all about empowering one another and walking one another back home to the heart and soul of ourselves.
Yeah, I love it. I tell people this way, that we live in a world of two different worlds. One, world of facts. Yeah. You can look around and that's factual. The beautiful thing about facts, they always change, because if you look at your life, when you were in a mess several years ago, you that was the fact. You thought that's it. Yep. But as time takes move by, that has changed. Truth never, ever, ever changes.
Correct.
And so once you find the truth about who you are, now you're beginning your journey. One of our customs here is to travel back in that time machine. I tell people that we access that time machine by our memories. Yeah. And we visit one of the very first spaces that we live a few years until we began to embark on our life and move on to create our space. What was your family like?
My family was a mishmash. So I'll go back. So my dad, he was half Dutch, half German, but just lived in Holland, just across the border. He passed away in 1988. He was 44. My mom is a big mishmash. My mom is very dark skinned. She's Indian Indonesian, with a splash of Belgian and a hint of French. So you mesh it all up, you know, and then you get me. I pop out
you.
The womb.
That's a miracle in itself right there. So here we go.
But I was raised pretty strict. Oh, they were strict.
Yeah.
And I look back at that now, Ken, and I wouldn't have it any other way. These days, kids seem to be able to do anything they want. But back in the 70s and 80s, it was very, very different.
Yeah. I try to explain to my kids my childhood. And I would tell them this way and they would laugh, but it was kind of like that. I said, if beating was an Olympic sport, my parents would have gotten some gold medals, because back then, you know, that type of mindset was, you know, and I understand how I came from British Guiana in South America, and I would tell them that child abuse was an Olympic sport back in my country. It was just part of life. You get beat by the I tell them your teacher beat you, the principal, the neighbor, the person in the street heard the news about it, and they showed up at your house and they were beating you. Everyone was beating you because everyone was vested in your performance and making sure that you were able to, you know, manage your ways and yourself in a specific manner. So here you are, strict parents, this mishmash, as you said, and you are in the midst of that. And that strictness of thinking and belief, what is your memory of you being in that type of situation?
What you mean, growing up?
Yeah.
Always following the rules. If not, we would be put in a corner, we get spanked. but really helping out with chores and making sure both me and my sister that we did everything right. And even when my dad passed away, it was like, oh, we better do this. Oh, we better get up on time. You know, we cannot have a lie-in, stuff like that. I think it was so peppered into us to live a certain way that we just abided by it. And it was the same for school. I mean, even when we didn't go to school, when there was no money for schooling, when we lived in Kuala Lumpur, we still had to open our books every single day from our parents until we went back to school, you know, probably 6-7 months later.
But that's interesting.
That was normal. It was, I don't know. I didn't know any different, you know, and everyone grows up differently and they don't know any different.
Yeah. Which route did you take? Because I know we are going to head there.
Yeah.
Because one in that situation, one becomes a perfectionist, or one becomes a rebellious individual against order. And the other is one becomes a people pleaser. So we have some beautiful choices within that type of
all of them
mindset. Because I know some of them. I've been there. I know what I'm talking about in this sense. So here you are, this young individual, have all of them. As you are going through your life, into heading into high school and stuff like that, Brigitte, what was that like? What was your relationship to others, friends and stuff like that?
It sucked because, you know, in Malaysia, I was abused by a friend of the family. And I always say this, Ken, in the 1980s, life was very different. I potted it up. I didn't understand it. I was like 10, 11 years old. And so when I went back to high school, that was in Holland, actually. I mean, even in Malaysia, but it was different because there was no differentiation between any of us because we wore school uniforms. And I do remember the caning at school. My parents were so against that kids being caned in front of everyone else.
Yeah.
And but anyhow, high school in Holland was very, very different because I was 13 when we went back. And I don't know, kids in Holland were different. It was like a culture shock to me. Everyone wore what they wanted to wear. And then my dad died several months later from coronary heart disease in July of 1988. And that just threw me completely because I was very close to my dad. He was very, very spiritual.
Yeah.
And that really dented my self-confidence. But not only that, I had an immense fear for boys. So my high school years were marked by trauma because I was also bullied. And going on a school trip to Belgium in the Ardennes, one of the kids just grabbed my arm in front of everyone else and was like, look how skinny she is. And that was just horrible. I just wanted to disappear. I would often go and, you know, I would never, if I could avoid it, never enter the school building from the main area. I would always go through the basement. And if I needed to go to a classroom, and it sounds really weird, I look back at it now and it's just insane. But if there was a guy in the corridor and my classroom was on the other end, I would hate to pass the guy in the hallway, and I would try and find another way to get to the classroom. That's how bad it was. It was such an ingrained fear within me, and I just wanted to disappear. That's why I walked around like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. I just didn't want to be seen. And I was never the brightest one. My sister was uber bright. And she didn't really have to study. I had to study so hard just to get my grades right. it was terrible. And even when I was in high school, at 15 years old, I started to work on Thursday nights and Saturdays at a department store just to help my mom out. Because, you know, my mom was on her own. When my dad passed away, she was left with a debt. And so she had to find work, and we wore secondhand clothes. I didn't really care, you know. Yeah. At least I didn't run around naked. So, I do remember that, and it makes you appreciate life more. But my mom was very, very strict as well. Oof. I used to be scared of her sometimes, especially when she got mad. It's like, oh my God, she's not talking to us. Oh my gosh. I said to my sister, she's not talking to us. How do we figure this out? And it took every ounce of each of us just to go back to her and apologize. And sometimes it would take days. Yeah, my high school was very, I was so glad when my high school was over. I made it with the skin of my teeth. And my sister, I mean, she had Latin and Greek, and she just passed with flying colors.
Yeah. Wow, that is so, Brigitte, here is this young woman, trauma all around her, trauma in school, trauma home with mom's silence and so forth, trauma with just surrounds her.
Yep.
As she is sitting, looking now into her future, looking into college and or towards that direction, what was the conversation you were having? I know your sister had the wherewithal as far as the mindset of education. Here you are, the worker bee. You started working early, pushing your way through. What was her mindset heading into that direction now on the path to becoming, Brigitte, the individual leaving home? What was that?
Oh, what a mess it was. So, I did go to college, but many, many years later, and all I did was a secretarial course at the time. But when I left high school, I really wanted to make something of myself. And I wanted to show the kids that I wasn't a nobody. And when I was 16, actually, my mom put me on this modeling course just to creak up my confidence, but it didn't really work because I was so marred with trauma. And what happened then is like a hairdresser picked me out from this show and said to me he wanted to use me as one of the main one of the main models for the hair show. What he forgot to tell me is he cut my hair, and he cut my hair from my shoulders into a pixie cut. And I looked at myself, and I could cry, Ken. I felt so ugly. I felt so ugly because it was my hair. It's like, why couldn't you just put a wig on me? But that wasn't done at that time. And I just had to go with it. And so I did do the hair show. I made that little bit of money. And from then on, I mean, I did have an agency, but I could never live off the modeling. It was a very cutthroat world, and people do sleep around. I was very naive. Yeah. I have been assaulted in the industry, which also, and that was actually in New York several years later, but it wasn't really for me, but I just felt I wanted to prove a point. So when many people might have gone to university and college at the time, I actually traveled the world. And I just wanted to be someone. But yeah, being a famous, I wanted to be famous. You know, we all have that when we're younger. But they just didn't like my look. They said, no, you look too much like Brooke Shields or Linda Evangelista. No, we don't like your look. And it was constant. It was constant, Ken. Every agency I went, either they took me on and was like, no, I'm sorry. Or this is a funny one. And one of the French agencies, when I went to Paris, they said, you cannot dress like that. You dress too conservative. But that was just me. I didn't want to show old skin. That wasn't me. That's not how I was raised. And so wherever I went in the world, actually, I just worked. I was a bartender. I was a hostess. I did promotion work just to stay afloat. And it didn't matter where you put me. I was a little chameleon. And I just adapted. Yeah.
Wow, that's a powerful story, Brigitte, because this young girl, the trauma, man, you lost your dad, your mom trying to hold things together, school, working, now you're heading towards your future, as they say. You're going into the skin game,
and yes,
that industry, basically, they have the totally different rules, because I have a few friends in there and so forth, and they talk about the horror stories, and yet here you are being poured day and night negative information as to who you are and your looks and so forth. What was happening to her?
Oh, a lot more was happening. It wasn't just the modeling industry. At that time, when I was 24, my stepdad passed away as well. He had cancer in the throat area. And I used to help my mom out every single weekend and go to her from London to Buckingham, which is about 1.5 hours away. And I'd just help her out. And when he crossed over, my mom actually really leaned on me emotionally, and I had no outlet. And so the friends that I surrounded myself with, they were into drugs. And so I started doing Molly, Coke, you name it, while still working during the day, because I was doing customer services. And I suffered from blackouts and memory loss. And I'll be very, very honest. I mean, having sex on drugs when you're not aware is a violation of your body. Yep. And at that point, when that happened, I stopped from one day to the next. And I carried that trauma with me for a long time as well. But I take full responsibility for that. But it was just that I always say to people, you can say that I had the wrong friends, but that wasn't about that. I guess I had a choice to experience that or not. And I chose the easy way out, and I chose to do drugs for several months. And I did tell my mom, and she said, are you still doing it? I said, no, I stopped from one day to the next. So I had that as well. But, you know, we all go through different experiences.
I think it, in my belief, I believe we go through it because we are trusted to come out of it on the other side, because someone is coming. Many people are going to be in that situation.
Yes.
And when one presents to you and you speak concerning that specific time in your life, they will truly be in a state of listening and hearing. And I tell people there's a difference that I've learned in my life. The natural man, he listens. The subconscious man, he hears. And so when you are talking to someone, when someone has presented to you and you are speaking to them about your time, if you will, they will hear you. Everything about that conversation changes. You'll see it in their eyes. You'll see it. And you can sense it. And it brings that conversation up to a different level where that individual now will be able to receive, because it's only in that space of hearing can you receive anything. When you're listening, you could be distracted by a song. But when you're hearing, you're focused. And so yes. I believe we go through those things because someone is going to need it at some point, Brigitte, and you will be able to present them with insights as to how to come out. Here's this girl in the midst of all of that, reverted to try drugs and stuff like that. Everyone, a lot of people are like that.
Yep.
Mom is broken. You are there. And you are now, you made a decision to excavate yourself from the drug part of your living.
Yep.
Where did you start to go once you made that decision? What direction and why did you pick that direction?
Oh, yeah. After that, I actually went to Istanbul. That's a good point. That's the only place that I actually really worked as a model, but I also started bartending there. And I just wanted to do that. That's just me. That was the start of my bartending journey. And yeah. I really, really loved it. Loved the culture, loved the people, never had any issues. And that's where I met my first ever boyfriend. I was 21 and a half. I was a late bloomer. And I was a freak of nature, because at that point it was like, oh my God, I kissed the guy. I have to be with the guy, but I'm not sure if I want to. And I look back at it now and it's like, but Brigitte, you didn't have to be with that guy. But at that point, I felt like I had to be with him because, oh my gosh, I had kissed him. Yeah, that's how messed up I was. And
wow.
Yeah, that. So, but all my relationships from that point on, I mean, they were traumatic because I didn't heal from my own trauma. So that's exactly what I attracted, and I needed to attract that to learn.
Yeah.
And that's why we're all reflections of one another. We're all beautiful teachers of one another. But it took me many more years to figure that one out because even though that relationship ended badly after 3 years, I wished him well. And I did. He did turn his life around. He's very successful now because this guy wanted to sell mops, and he was Turkish, but was living in Germany. And my stepdad, the one that died from cancer, he put us in the phone book as Hitler and Eva Braun. I said, he was just nuts. I mean, he really had a wicked sense of humor, though. He still does up there.
I don't know what to say about that. There's no what to say about that one. That was something else. That's
an
interesting humor that he had.
Oh, tell me about it. But even when I was living in Germany after that, because I moved to Germany. Actually, that's a lie. This is a funny story, Ken. From Turkey, from Istanbul, I went back to my mom's, and that's when I did the secretarial course. So I was well in my 20s at the time. And I wanted to take the shortest course, because I didn't want to stay at my mom's. And my mom was like, my mom didn't want to let me go. So I applied to work as a stewardess on two airlines, Bahrain Airlines and Virgin Airlines. So I had an interview with Bahrain Airlines, and the lady was from Malaysia, and she looked at me like this. She's like, oh my God, you're so tall. So I didn't get that one. But then there was a letter that came through for Virgin, and I was invited to go to to an interview. But I scooped up the letter in the mail before my mom saw it, and I was determined to get out. My mom was so mad at me. She's like, how can you live with this guy in Germany? And, you know, it kind of kicked me out, but I'd already booked my ticket, and I left. And I didn't talk to her for a couple of years. And so I went to live in Germany, and that was it was a difficult time for me. It really, really was. I mean, I had anger, fits of anger. I was very different back then. I remember breaking plates. And the reason I broke plates is because I was frustrated. And I'd seen my dad do that in the past, you know, get a plate, break it. So these are things, you know, I mean, we're raised according to the conditioning of our parents. And these are just things that I remember. But the relationship was so difficult. We were like two peas in a pod. But he wanted to sell mops. And I said, don't be silly. I said, you've got such a good education in computer sciences. I said, do something with it. And he actually did. He's doing very well for himself now. I mean, he married somebody he met way before me. But he's doing very, very well now.
So here you are. You're in the midst. You ran from mom. You're in a relationship, of course. When one is not healed, that relationship will always be a roller coaster ride.
Absolutely.
After that roller coaster ride is over and you are getting off of the cart, if you will, trying to get your balance because you're a little off kilter from that spinning on in that ride. Where did you begin to look? What were you thinking as, what do I need to do? You know, those questions we ask. Why am I here? How am I going to fix this mess that I'm in? How did you begin to, quote unquote, fix this mess that I'm in as you got out of that relationship?
I got into more of a mess. But
let me hear this one, girl. Let me hear about this.
I was one messed up bunny, I was. But I do remember at the time when my stepdad was still alive, he said he was going to come and get me. And I'm like, no, do not come and get me from Germany. I'm fine. I'll make it. So I had to leave my little minor bird behind with a friend of mine and my little gerbil Pinky. I'm like, I couldn't take Pinky. My mom's like, I'm not having a little gerbil in the house. So the thing was a really tiny bit Pinky. I love that little thing. And I had to set it free in the woods. I don't think it survived for very long, but yes. And so when I went back with nothing, just my clothes. And my ex said I owed him money for rent. So I paid it and I left. And I stayed in the UK for several years until I actually started traveling again. And that was more as well for the modeling. So I went everywhere, Miami, New York. Miami is terrible, terrible.
Yeah.
Oh, it's horrific. Very superficial. I mean, but the modeling industry is very superficial. So it's not like what Stevie Wonder saying, you know, you got to be superstitious. No, it's like, you got to be superficial.
Well, this plane that we call the natural realm, all the senses that they are aware of are those five senses, you know, and that is the natural realm. But there's another sense that one taps into, and they can only, everything that they do is geared to those five senses, everything, because they don't know anything else. And I think if they knew how to manipulate the other sense, we'd be damn, we would be dumb. I mean, it'll be horrible. They, you know, that's, we call it the sixth sense. That is the internal compass. That is the soul. If they learn how to manipulate that, man would be a mess. And so, but look what they have done from manipulating those five senses, what we touch and see and hear and all that stuff. And so that's all they have. That's all they have. Yep. And they can't speak to the inner questions that one asks. Why am I not happy? What's going on? All those different questions that will probe, is designed to probe the inner man, not the superficial being. So here you are engaging in that wonderful world of, you know, traveling with, you know, modeling and all that stuff. But you also are exposed to a great deal of mindset, different mindsets, how individual think and believe and believe. And there's some really strange one in that field, man. I hung out with a couple of them. So here you are. What was it Brigitte, as you're standing all this stuff, traveling, seeing all these different things in pain and trauma, how did you start to navigate towards the compass, the inner being? What was it, that situation, that caused you to begin to ask those deep questions, that of your soul versus this the superficial thing, being? What was that incident?
I think my compass was missing the little arrow. I had to find that thing first.
I know about that, you know.
Even in relationships, and I remember going to New York for this guy that wanted, actually, he loved me, but then he didn't love me, and then he dumped me, and then he took me back, and I was very needy, and I was like, well, what am I doing wrong? And it was really like finding that happiness without myself. And I often ask, like, why can I not be happy? Why is everyone so happy around me? Why can I not be happy? What am I doing wrong here? And my superpower was, of course, it was not eating. I was super skinny. I was very good at that. I did that from a very young age. That's something I could control. And the same with my work. That was something I could control.
Yeah.
And it actually took me till like 2009 when I was living with someone. He's in the States now, but he came to Holland. Actually, that's a lie. I bought his ticket. I had a very good job working for Shell at the time. But that was I really hit rock bottom, and I needed to hit rock bottom because the universe was going, oh my God, what is she doing? Oh my goodness. You know, maybe we need to put another character in her life story and see what she's going to do now. And so he was really the catalyst to my healing. What happened there was he was like his part-time crack addict, something I just didn't know. And so he came to Holland, and I was also looking for jobs for him whilst I was working my own job. And he didn't have a social for Holland. And so he did the odd jobs, you know, for cash under the table. And he seemed to be fine at first. And then he slipped back. And just because I'd done drugs, this was completely different. Oh my gosh, I'd never seen someone high on crack and with crack hands. Yeah. And it really broke my heart, Ken, to see such a soul in such an amount of pain. And he'd been through his own trauma, his childhood trauma. Funnily enough, controlling mother. And he wanted to get better, but no clinic in Holland took him on because he didn't have a social. So it was like a catch-22. And another said, yes, but he needs to get sober before we take him in. Oh, how does that work when he wants the help? And then he just fell off the rails. And, you know, he even broke into my home. He pawned some of my stuff. I remember him saying this. He said, Brigitte, if I die, please tell my son that I love him. And he landed in bed with the Dutch Crips. And I didn't think of it much at the time. I thought maybe he'd turn his life around, but then it got out of hand because he stole from them and then he was held for ransom. In short, he was held for ransom and the police got involved. And I actually helped them locate my ex, and he was deported back to the US. And in that space of time, my mom came over, and you know, she'd spoken to the police as well. And the police asked my mom, oh, is your daughter staying here or are you taking her back to the UK? My mom says, no, I found a place for her that she can rent. So I signed the contract, and I was out of Holland in the space of a few days. And the leader of the Crips actually called me, and thankfully I just left. And he said, if I ever find you, I'm going to kill you. Wow. And that shook me to my core. And I was just sitting there. I was so far gone in my mind, you know, because I'd been in that fight or flight mode syndrome for so long. I just downed a whole box of ibuprofen, very lame attempt at my life. And I woke up the next day after 12 hours sleep. And my mom just said to me, Brigitte, she said, why don't you go and see a counselor? I did. I made an appointment, went to see one, and she listened to my story. She didn't hear me, she listened.
Yeah.
And at the end of the session, she said to me, "Brigitta, you know, listening to you, you'll be fine. You're strong enough. You'll get through this." And that didn't help me. So I had to figure out, you know, how to get better, because I couldn't go on like this anymore. It was like I had a body, but my soul wasn't there. That's how I felt. Yeah. There was such a void within. And I found a Reiki healer. And as I always say about this person, she was my saving grace at the time. And she even said to me, "Brigitta, you're a people pleaser, because yeah. you're so afraid of hurting others. You want to save other people, but you cannot save other people. People need to save themselves. Yeah. You need to allow for people to walk their own journey as much as you need to walk your own journey." And I studied under her, not in a weekend. It was 1.5 years for level 1 and 2. Yeah. I mean, these days, yeah. Ken, trust me, you can do it in a weekend. Oh, you're a healer.
Reiki, Reiki takes a while. I know.
It does.
People takes years to get to that place where one can be a true practitioner of the art.
Yes.
It is not something that one can take lightly. You have to learn how to sense energies, manipulate yes. energies from distance as well, all of those different things that
yeah.
comes within the learning of that craft. And again, you can get the 4-hour, but to become a master Reiki, it's going to take you some time.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It did. And I will say this about my ex. He's doing well now. He's like a beautiful soul that's just blossoming. And yeah. I love the fact that he's now turned his life around. It took him quite a few more years to see the light, but these were his experiences and this was his yeah. journey. But it's beautiful to see the progress.
As you begin to have this conversation with your Reiki teacher and your mentor, mm-hmm. What did you start to notice about you?
Oh, I needed to do a lot of healing. That's first and foremost. But it was really peeling back the layers of who I thought I was, but I wasn't. Letting go of that identity, because we create an identity, you know, and I call that the ego, the character. But I studied so many other healing modalities, from drug and alcohol addiction to EFT, the emotional freedom technique, which I think is a beautiful healing technique. Holistic nutrition, I became a meditation teacher, I studied that, and so many other healing modalities, because I just wanted to understand more about myself, but also how I could heal myself, but also how I could heal other people. So that was kind of the catalyst. Had I not met my ex, I might have just climbed the career ladder in Shell.
Yeah.
And so I'm so, so grateful that he was a part of my journey. And I mean, just because stuff happens in our youth that may not be our fault, at the end yeah. of the day, when we grow up, we still need to take responsibility for that, because yeah. we're responsible for our own joy, our own happiness in life. And that wasn't the end of my troubles. Of course not, because I had so much more to learn. Just because I studied many healing modalities doesn't mean that was, I was all of a sudden enlightened. Oh, heck no.
That's the beginning.
It was the beginning. Oh, it was the yeah. beginning. I look back now and I think, wow, from where I was at that point in my life to where I am now, there's such a great, great big difference. But I bought a house in 2013. I bought a place in St. Petersburg in Florida. I just felt a pull towards it. And I kind of went with my gut. Yeah, I think my compass was starting to get intact. So yeah. I bought a, it was bank owned, and a lot of work needed to be done in it. But I really loved that home. But I met somebody online, and he lived out there, and he was somebody that was very, very needy and very clingy. And then he lost his mom, bless his soul, and he fell into this big depression. And not only that, he had a reckless, and he didn't pay it, and then he had an arrest warrant over his head after many, many months. Then he moved from an hour away to two doors down from me, and I didn't even want to be with him anymore. He had my keys, yeah. Refused to return them. He had threatened me with immigration. Wow. And he said, no, I didn't. I said, yes, you did. And there was stuff that I wore. And he's like, I'm not going out with you like that. You cannot wear that. So it was this constant, like, control. And I felt very trapped in my own home. And, yeah. You know, I tried to help him because he couldn't find a job. And again, I paid his bills. I helped pay his bills. But I was the one that was working 7 days a week. Yeah. And that wasn't fair on me. And I think I was running away from my emotions because I was very, very good at that, at suppressing them. I always say I played Houdini with my emotions. And again, that was working so much and also not eating properly. That was just a constant red thread in my life. And he eventually, I moved. I put my home on the market just to get away from him, which is insane. And at that point, he was being evicted as well. And he said, Brigitte, please, 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 I need you to pay the deposit for me. He's like, I promise I'll sign the contract and I'll pay it back. I will pay it back. That never happened. But I moved and you know, it's funny because it's ironic because he lived so close to me when he moved to his studio. And even then I was still helping him out. And at one point he had to have his place tented, and I was at the end of my rope at that point. And he said, well, I told the landlord that I can stay with you. I'm like, excuse me? And I said, no, you cannot stay with me. And oh my goodness, then I had to find him a hotel. I had to pay the hotel. I had to pay for his two fat cats. And so I did that for several days. And then when he said to me, look, it's not finished yet. They said the end of the day. And I'm like, oh, goodness gracious. So I got in my car and I got him. And at that point, my mind was shot because I couldn't do this anymore, Ken. I just couldn't. And I jumped every freaking red light. I just weaved through traffic, get back home. I don't even know how I wasn't stopped by cops. But at that point, I didn't even care if I lived or died. Yeah. I was so far gone. And he was sitting in the car, like, looking at me. And I was just screaming at him. And, you know, so often in the dark, I had screamed at the universe too. Like, why is this happening to me? I cannot do this anymore. And so from that point, after that, he kind of left me alone. And that's when I started to listen. And it came in the form of a little breadcrumb of my sister who had done kambo treatment. And kambo treatment is shamanic frog healing. Yeah. And it's where these, I think they're cute, these nocturnal Amazonian frogs. They thrive in the Amazon forest. Mm-hmm. And many of the Indian tribes, actually Native American Indian tribes, they scrape the poison from these little frogs. Don't worry, they don't die. They croak happily ever after. And I went to see a shaman in Florida, several hours from my home. I didn't do too much research, and I thought I'm just going to go with it. I did. And oh my God, oh my God. I can tell you that was extremely physical. I thought I was gonna die. I was sitting there, and he, you know, burns the points into my skin on my leg. Thank the heavens it was my leg. And puts the poison on, and I'm like, 10 seconds, it shot to my head, you know, and I'd been drinking water as well. You need to drink like 2 liters of water. And I had this yellow happy bucket next to me. So I was purging, and then I had to run to the toilet. And, you know, the shaman just helped me up because he's so used to it. And he accompanied me, and it took like 4 hours, this whole process. And he said to me after that, he said, Brigitte, do you know why it took you so long? I'm like, no, why? And he's like, because your ego was battling you. He's like, you were so set in your ways, so set in your ways. I said, yes, I know. And he's like, but after 4 hours, it finally broke. And even though it's extremely physical, I was also far more clearer in my head. And when I went back home, I mean, I went and I did it 2 more times, but I went back home, Ken, and I made a bucket list of things that I wanted to do. And so on top of the list was skydiving. I'm a weirdo. Yeah. I know. I'm scared of heights, but I did it. And I remember the instructor saying, well, are you ready for this? Yeah, I'm ready for this. Thinking, no, 13,000 feet. And I had no choice because I was strapped to him. So I had, you know, when he jumps, I jumped. And I do remember it. I mean, it was actually pretty amazing, but I was so glad when my feet touched the ground again. And I promised like my stepdad in 2000 before he crossed over that I was gonna run for charity. And I finally did that in 2016. I started running for charity. I did that. I went hang gliding as well, sat on an alligator. I think they're beautiful creatures. And then several weeks after I went for Kumbho treatment, my guides were like, or the universe was like, Brigitte, you're going to this fair. No, I don't want to go to the fair. It was like I was being kicked out of my house to go. Yeah. And it was only 5 minutes walk. And I went. And that's where I met my former mentor, Alania Starhawk. And she is an Akashic record healer. So she walks people through their past lives. And it was really, really interesting, Ken, because it's such a powerful form of healing. And she had no idea that when I had met my ex, the Floridian ex, that I started to lose a lot of weight and I suffered from severe stomach issues. I couldn't even hold in any food. And I look back at one of the pictures, you know, several of the pictures I still have, and I was really skin over bones. It wasn't even normal. Mm. I couldn't even hold down a cup of tea, and I didn't understand why. And she didn't know any of that. And so she went back to a past life around the Middle Ages where I was pretty well off. I was dealing in herbs, and my ex, who was a partner in that lifetime, he came onto my path, and he was a bit of a charlatan. And what happened was he really wanted to climb the social ladder, and he had poisoned me with an arsenic type, and under the guise of when I fell ill that he would heal me, but he poisoned me bit by bit over several months, and it hit my stomach. And so when I met him in this lifetime, that was like, it was like a flare up. And so that she healed all of that. And I told her afterwards, and she's like, that is really amazing. But he left me alone completely after that. And he started to work on his own life, rebuilding his own life, which is what he had needed to do. But sometimes the energy just gets stuck. You know, we go into this lifetime, and as you said, we come in with trauma, but sometimes we also come in with past life trauma that's still attached to us that we need to work out in this life. And he's doing very well for himself now. Very, very, very well. So I'm glad he is. But Yeah, and from that point on, actually, I did several more healing sessions, but she also taught me channeling, which I learned through one of her workshops. And yeah. Channeling is something, you could call it automatic writing. It was something that I was new to because, you know, I taught Reiki to my students because I became a Reiki master and I did a lot of workshops. Just helping to empower people and allowing people to unfold, to actually blossom within their own healing journey. But this was something else. And I went to that workshop and it was, well, it was packed. And I was sitting somewhere in a corner because I'm this antisocial shitbird and everyone's sitting in this circle. And so when she did a meditation, I was gone. I don't even know where I went. I know when she counted back from 3 to 1, I was back in the room. Everyone had seen the ascended masters, the archangels, the guides and colors, got messages. Well, I got diddly squat, nothing, nada, niente. And I was really upset. I'll tell you what, I was upset. And so there's one beautiful exercise that she gave and how she started her journey channeling. And that was that she got a piece of paper and a pad, and she just said to her guides in the universe, "I'm open and ready to receive." Well, that stuck with me. And so I went home straight after the course, and that's exactly what I did that night. I did it that night. And I think my mind was so shot at that point that it just started to flow. And it was old English prose, and it was just, I was actually crying tears of joy. Because I felt this is something that really resonated with me. And I asked so many questions in the weeks and months that followed. And then I started using my cards because it really was about self-healing at that point in time. And so then I also started to use my cards and whatever came out, whether that was an ascended master, an archangel, whatever, I would just put it in front of me and say, "Is there any message you'd like to convey? Did you have any past lives? What do you stand for?" And I would just, whatever came to me, I would just write it down. And it's like riding a bike. You've got to learn.
Yeah.
And now it's just second nature to me.
Yeah, that is awesome. let me ask you something, Birgitte. It's a lot of information, a lot of living, if you will. You're going through and learning. How did you begin to fall in love with you? Because all this time, you know, we learn, we gather data, if you will, from all the different folks and so forth. But yet we still have to have that conversation with the self. And here is this woman, this young woman, all her life. She was in the skin game, as I said earlier. You weren't good enough, you weren't beautiful, you weren't here, but yet you were still in the field in Miami and traveling. How did you begin that road to fall in love with yourself? Because you were given data that is contrary to being in love with yourself. How did that begin?
I think that was the start of it. I do remember going back to the UK in 2017. I overstayed my welcome in the US. I had no more money, so I had to sell everything. Then I had to put my dog for vaccinations. But I went back and I said to my mom, "I've achieved nothing." I said, "Look at everyone around me. They've got a home, they're married, they've got kids." And she looked at me and she's like, "But Birgitte, you've traveled the world. You've done so much in your life. You've achieved so much. It's just different. But do not sell yourself short." So as you can see, I was still struggling with myself. It was a journey. It's not like, hey, from one day to the next, woof, oh, I love myself, oh, I'm good with myself. No. it didn't work like that. It was over the years from probably 2017 to now. And I think once I started writing my book, my first book, Becoming Authentically Me, working with the many master teachers, that I finally started to understand why self-love was so important, nurturing and nourishing yourself, having compassion for yourself. I started to also forgive a lot of people, forgiving myself. Because many times, we've all done this, Ken. We walk around with bitterness, opinions of others, frustrations, but it doesn't matter if we're in a relationship with someone, interpersonal relationships, families, everyone can be a trigger. We're reflections of one another. I needed to understand that. And I needed to get rid of that, some of the bitterness that was still there. And by writing that, I understood so much more. And it's also very healing to write.
Yeah.
And so is journaling, if people want to journal. Very, very healing, because you write it away from you and you see things from a different perspective. But I always say the Ascended Masters, the Archangels, the Light Beings, they helped me so, so much during that, what we call lockdown. Even though I was working in corporate, they told me I had to write this book, and I did. So that was a very, very healing journey for me. And I love myself far more than years ago. And it's still a journey. You know, I'm not perfect. I'm not perfect. Sometimes I beat myself up. I did so last year when I was working 70 hours a week. And I fell back into some of my old coping mechanisms. And it's okay. We sometimes do that. But we shouldn't put ourselves in the boxing ring and beat ourselves to a pulp, which is what a lot of people do. It doesn't really matter what people think of you, but it matters what you think of you. But we're so ingrained within this society to compare ourselves to one another. But and that's just the way society has been created. You can see it in social media. It's like, you know what, I should live a certain way. I should be a certain way. No, you should just be you. Just be you and not live your life according to what society tells you to be or wants you to be.
That's how they control them, Brigitte. They tell us how we ought to speak, act, walk, what we should do. And that fence, the way by which they control us all, because there's millions and billions of us, is a terminology that one must be normal. And outside of normal is a problem. I tell people I don't want to be perfect. I want to be open. I want forever to be open to learn. Yeah. I think perfection would make me bored.
Yes.
If I got there. So I don't want it. I don't want perfection. I want to be open to learn more and to be encounter more experience and so forth. So I don't like perfection at all. I don't want it. You know, so here you are. You followed, you were obedient to your guides and so forth, and they instructed you about writing the book. Once you completed the book and now you're walking towards your assignment as to how you serve today, how did that happen? How did that piece came together? And when you got your quote unquote first client, if you will, the first person that came into your space, because we go through all the other things, imposter syndrome and all this kind of stuff, whatever. But as you are moving through and you did all of that, you're obedient, and then the manifestations of your clients began, and you're now beginning to serve. Mm-hmm. How did you look at yourself when that happened? The transition, of course, with people, but more so you, looking back at that girl that started with mom and dad in the sense where they have to get everything right. She's nervous and her sister are holding it together. That distance in time, how did you look at that?
Wow, the world of difference now from the insecure person that I was, that didn't value myself, hated myself, to who I am now. But honestly, I'm still a work in progress, of course.
Yep.
But my clients, I learned light language about 1.5 years ago. I always had it in me, but I just needed to verbalize it. And it took my mentor, Sharon Purcell, to kick me off the edge of the cliff. Because that's exactly what I told it to do. And it just started to flow. And I love it. I'm so humbled by being able to do that. And when I have my clients, it was one of these things. And I will say this, you know, after writing my book, my confidence, I became a different person. So whereas I used to be afraid to speak up, now I'm not afraid anymore, because it's all about being true to ourselves. Yeah. And yeah, I'm not afraid to with people. I always say to people, it doesn't matter how you treat me. If you think I'm like Marmite, that's great. You either love me or hate me, or you think I'm okay. It doesn't matter to me. I still love you anyway. So So I remember getting my first client, and it was only a short session. And it was like, that was actually guinea pig. But it was kind of amazing. But even my light language from then to now has also, you know, progressed and developed, because I like to get my achievements, and I love developing, and I'm always open to new things, because life is one big learning curve. It's a whole experiment for us all to experience. It's so beautiful, even the crappy parts. But yes, I had a client, and she had to go into hospital, and she had such an immense fear for the surgery. And I did for 5 minutes. And then she's like, she said to me a week later, she's like, do you know what? I didn't even think of it. She's like, I just went in, had surgery, and went out, and nothing. She's like, the fear was gone. I've had another one. She's now able to walk again. She had severe issues with walking because of a hysterectomy, and she could only walk for 1 or 2 minutes because her back was so bad, but now she can just walk again. I love that. Another one, she's a client. She was my latest. She had, she also has back issues, but I told her, look, when you heal, it goes in layers, and the healing will go where it's supposed to go. And so she was a little impatient. And then she said to me yesterday, she's like, oh my gosh, I feel so much better. I just love that. I love that. And I always say to people, look, just because I do light language doesn't mean that it agrees with your spirit. You have to do whatever aligns with your own spirit. And if that's another form of therapy, then do that. I'm not a Yosemite Sam, you know, standing there, you have to do light language because it will help you. Yes. No, I'm not like that. I'm not wired that way. But I love doing it. I'm just very humbled, and it's slowly starting to grow. And eventually I do want to transition out of my corporate job and do this full time. I really want to empower people and inspire them that there is life after trauma, and that we can overcome. We can overcome anything, really. Yeah. You know, trauma does not define you. Your experiences don't define you, but you define your experiences. And it's just taking that accountability for your life rather than to point the fingers at others, because that's really easy, Ken. It's really easy to deflect rather than to reflect and say, hey, you know what? Actually, what do I need to work on to make my life better? Yeah, to change the energy within. Everything starts from within. It doesn't start from without. We are either our own. We have the key to healing ourselves, but we also have the key to the red button within ourselves to self-destruct. Yeah. So
I can't put it any other way. I'm going to put it right there. All of you guys that have been listening to us, I do appreciate you coming by and stopping and engaging in our conversation here at Threads of Enlightenment. I'm going to provide everything for you guys to get access to her, because as she stated, she has been able to help others. You need to find that space by which you can receive. If it's not, and that's what she's talking about, whatever modality speaks to you, that is where you ought to be, because you will receive more there. If you are not in a space by which you will resist, and there is no healing in resisting, one must learn to surrender. So find that modality by which you are going to surrender. And when you surrender, you will receive your healing. We're going to provide everything again for you guys to get access to Brigitte. I want you guys to, those that are listening, get into her space. If you know friends and family, get them there so that she can help them. And you heard her, her wish and her desire is to transition from the job and become a full-time full-timer, if you will, with her assignment. So let us assist her to get there. So get everyone in our space so that she can achieve her desired outcome. Brigitte, thank you so much for coming to Threads of Enlightenment.
Thank you so much for having me, Ken.
It is my honor.